Hello everyone and welcome to a new Impact Pool podcast episode. Today our guest is David Burfield, who is the Director of Human Resources at the United Nations Development Programme, the UNDP. Welcome David.
Hi, nice to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. Let's just kick off with the first sort of open question. Could you maybe tell us what your road in life has been up to now and how it influenced the position you're in right now?
Yeah, well, it seems to be, at my age, a longish road, but I originally grew up in a small seaside town in England, and I was, I think, lucky enough at the time to benefit from a lot of the provisions of the welfare state, which provided me with, you know, great education and access to books and all kinds of things, and I was fortunate enough then to be able to be the first ever in my wider family to have stayed at school beyond the normal leaving age and went to university, where I had some fantastic, you know, opportunities to get involved in all kinds of things, in particular student politics, which, in, you know, really opened my eyes to a lot of stuff and gave me some great experience of actually leading organizations at a very young age. And I studied languages, but soon realized I didn't want to do that for a career as an interpreter or a translator, and joined the UK Civil Service graduate program.
Okay.
I think I was actually the first person in my university to ever join that. And it was really interesting. I got sent to the Transport Ministry and was negotiating on an EU directive at the time. And because of that, when the UK had the presidency of the European Union in 1992, they wanted extra people to come to the permanent representation. And because I had experience and I spoke languages, I was asked to join the diplomatic service and also a thing called the European Fast Stream. They set up to get more British people into the EU. It all seems a long time ago. Anyway, I realized once I got to Brussels that this was really where I wanted to be. And so I was lucky enough to pass the exams to join the European Union Civil Service. And so I never went back to London or the UK. And so in 1993, I joined the European Commission and spent 25 years there actually doing a whole variety of different things. A lot of them around communications, human resources, internal audit, change management, including working as the assistant to the head of HR at the time, and also in the private office, or cabinet as they call it there, two vice presidents of the European Commission. And the last 11 years were spent as the director of the European Personnel Selection Office, where I introduced a lot of reforms to the way that the EU recruits its staff. And after all of that, after 25 years, I thought it was really time for a change. Following Brexit, I also became a Swedish citizen. It's my wife
really?
Is Swedish. and I really thought, well, maybe it's time for a shift in focus and emphasis. I knew I was passionate about working in international organizations, passionate about human resources and about changing things. And then this opportunity came up in UNDP to lead the transformation of HR, the whole function corporately. And I thought this was really exciting. So I've now been here for just over five years, working on our People for 2030 strategy. And outside that, what's my journey? Well, I've got five kids altogether, three my own and two stepchildren. And two step-grandchildren. Our youngest son has actually just started university, so I'm now officially an empty nester for the first time in over 30 years. And I do a lot of other things when I'm not working, in particular photography, road biking, and a bunch of other stuff. So I hope that gives you a bit of an idea.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Well, that definitely gives me an idea. Busy man, it sounds, also with all the hobbies that you have. Something, though, I'm just curious. You mentioned in the beginning when you went to university and in the introduction, I might be wrong, but it almost sounded like there is a sense of privilege there. Does that somehow influence the way you view the work at the UNDP?
Yes. Look, I mean, I think you should say, first of all, privilege is a very relative thing, right? And I was lucky enough, you know, to grow up in the UK at a time as well where, you know, there was an awful lot of help and support that enabled, I suppose, the word didn't exist then, but now people will call it social mobility.
Yeah.
To move from, I grew up in a one-parent family. We didn't have a lot of money. You know, as I said, nobody had ever, you know, stayed at school. People in my family worked in shops or drove buses or lorries, delivered things, you know, all these kinds of things. Nothing wrong, you know, perfectly, you know, great occupations, but nobody had ever, you know, gone to university. So I really had that sense of realizing that I'd, you know, I'd been really lucky. I'd worked hard, but I was very lucky to have those opportunities. And joining things like this, you know, the civil service fast stream, or even more so the diplomatic service, realized I was, you know, in a circle of people that was very different to the people I'd grown up with.
Yeah.
And recognizing that, you know, that there weren't many people like me. As you move through life, you realize that many people are really talented, but they haven't had the opportunities. And in fact, as my daughter-in-law said to me recently, you know, it's a bit like running a 100-meter race. Only some people start, they don't start from the starting line. They start 50 meters back on a 100-meter course or 100 meters back, and they have to overcome the distance and lots of obstacles just to even start the race, where other people have already down the track.
Yeah.
And so I think one thing that really left me with, you know, in the jobs I've had, and particularly now, is to make sure that we recognize that and we give people from more disadvantaged backgrounds, you know, those opportunities. And I think if somebody had said to me when I was 16, you know, are you going to join the United Nations one day? I'd have probably laughed. You know, it didn't even occur to me. It wasn't in my realm of possibilities.
Yeah, yeah.
That working for UNDP here in New York was a possibility. And I think for many other people, they just forget it, you know, that, well, it's not, I'll never get there. And I think that's really, really important, because there's an awful lot of hugely talented people. And I'm very passionate about giving those people those opportunities.
Well, you're in a good position now to help facilitate that.
Yeah.
Hey, something I picked up on your, I think it was on LinkedIn, is that you state that you have a very strong belief in the positive impact of human resources management, or it can make in the international public sector and its contribution it can make to society more broadly. Can you elaborate on that statement? Where does that belief come from?
Well, you know, it really comes from my, you know, just my experience working. I mean, if you just look, you know, at organizations, in fact, many organizations, but particularly in the public sector and international organizations. Well, what have we got, right? It's the people. There isn't anything else. Their organizations are made up of, you know, the intelligence, the skills, the commitment, the passion, and the courage of the people that work for them. And so if you don't, you know, that's the by far the biggest asset that we have. And therefore, by really placing that front and center of what we do, and how can we ensure that we work in such ways we are able to unleash the full potential of everyone who's working for the organization, surely that has the potential above everything else to have an enormous impact on our ability to deliver. And so that's really why I'm you know, convinced, and you know, more convinced than ever after 5 years here in UNDP, how important that is. And and, you know, really, you know, it really struck me coming in. It still strikes me, even if it sounds a bit cheesy, perhaps. But, you know, it is such a group of motivated, purpose-driven people in this organization. And I see it right across the UN system, you know, my interactions with my counterparts. People really have a sense of belief, of purpose. And if we can make sure that we have a way of managing people that it doesn't demotivate them, it doesn't make them not share their passion, their ideas, and give everything they have to give and feel fulfilled and develop themselves personally and professionally, that's a real missed opportunity. And I also think HR also has to reinvent itself, because what HR people very often say, oh, you know, people don't take us seriously, we don't have a seat at the top table, And I kind of get it. But the reason is, I think HR, first of all, has been synonymous too often with admin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, administration of people. That's not the same as people management and human resources management. And the second is that you have to show the people running organizations how your contribution is going to actually have a positive impact on the ability to deliver and the outcomes of the organization. And that's what we've really tried to do in People for 2030.
Do you feel that before you joined the UNDP, or maybe generally speaking, where over the last maybe, I don't know, 15 years, UN and affiliated organizations come from, that there was a lot of, how would you phrase that, disregard for people's potential?
I don't think so. I mean, I think people can see it, but we, I think, just hadn't invented or invested in the systems
right
that enabled that to really flourish, and couldn't see perhaps that there were ways that we were working that weren't enabling that. So, for example, when I came to UNDP and before coming up with the people strategy, we spent months and months listening to people right across the organization. And the number one thing that people told me is that they thought they had a job, but not necessarily a career. And that's not a fact that, you know, UNDP was saying, we don't want you to have a career. But I think it was just they hadn't put in place the mechanisms, the systems, the incentives
right
to make that easier rather than more difficult. And so that, you know, some people just thought, okay, well, if I want to develop my career, then I need to go somewhere else. That's not what the organization wanted. So they weren't interested. And that's why I think if you actually bring HR expert practitioners in and you can identify, well, you know, what are the mechanisms we need to make that better? And now we can already actually see the transformation. We can put numbers on it.
Uh-huh.
We can measure the positive impact in our organization
yeah.
of some of the things that we've done.
And what would you say is the crux of that element that people said, okay, I've got a job, I don't have a career. What was the major thing that you had to, I guess, change? If it was maybe even behaviors, because sometimes people are stuck in a paradigm and they think, okay, this is how it is.
Yeah, I think the difficulty is, and that was really what underpins the people strategy we're pursuing, there's no one lever you pull to make that happen.
Yeah.
So what we tried to do is to get to the root cause of everything, which is what you can call an integrated talent management system.
Yeah.
And you have to put a whole load of blocks in place and then get them to work as a system to address it. So there are some things that particularly bear on career development. There are others that on our ability to attract and select the right people for the organization. So when it comes to, you know, the whole career issue, part of that, you know, is about ensuring that, you know, we actually map out career paths for people,
yeah.
that we give people access to the right training that they need to be able to, you know, develop their careers. Part of it is removing some barriers that were inadvertently there that actually made it more difficult for people to move from one post to another.
Yeah.
So we've, you know, removed those barriers. And one of them is also technological. So introducing an AI-enabled system where we get all of our personnel to put their skills into a database so we actually know what we've got and we can say, okay, over here, there might be something for you over there.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that's been a game changer is we've started to, you know, publish posts internally before we publish them externally.
Right.
And so what we can see is overall, in the last, I think, 2 years alone, the proportion of vacancies going to internal candidates has risen by about a third.
Well, that's good.
And that's a big jump.
Yeah, absolutely. Good decision, if I may say so. Oh, I think. The strategy, I think, as you explained, it forms a large basis of the work that you're doing right now. In terms of a personal perspective, what makes a program relevant to you? If you're speaking from the heart, if I may say so.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of things that I suppose, you know, stand out. But I think the real thing is to be able to have this opportunity to transform the way that, you know, we do HR and people management, in that where we've been able to not be constrained by this is the way it's always been done or this is the way everyone else does it, and you know, to really have that freedom and encouragement to do that has been the great thing for me. You know, I mean, I think it's very unusual in my experience that you find somebody right at the top of an organization, a huge organization like UNDP, and, you know, in this case, you know, our administrator, you know, Achim Steiner, who is really convinced of the importance of HR and people management in the organization. And so that's been a crucial factor for me in actually being able to make those changes, that, you know, we're not constantly being constrained or told you can't do something. Mm-hmm. On the contrary, it's this constant encouragement and personal sponsorship by him and other members of the senior management in UNDP to actually make those changes. And that's been fantastic for me, you know, to be able to actually do that. Because often people say, yeah, we want you to change these things. And when it comes to it, maybe not quite as much. And that's not been my experience in UNDP. And that, you know, that's really helped us, that support. And to be able to now to sit back and say, well, sit back, there's almost a chance of that. But to reflect, if you like, over the last 5 years and say, look, these are the things that we've changed. You know, these are really positive things that we can point to. I mean, for me, a couple of the standouts is that paying interns. I think that's so important.
Yeah.
We're a development organization, right? You know, and I heard, you know, really, you know, some sad stories. And one of them still sticks in my mind, that the our resident representative in Eswatini told me that this is about going back 3 years or so, that they'd lost their best intern because she couldn't afford the minibus fare to work.
Oh, dear.
That's not okay.
No.
You know, and it's the first rung on the career ladder. And if you can't get to the first rung, you've got even less chance of getting to the second rung. And we want people from program countries. We want people who have experienced the problems that we're trying to help solve, right? Because that gives you a direct personal perspective and a stake in solving them. So by paying interns, I think that's a game changer for our organization. And, you know, even if they don't stay with us, they've got a great opportunity, you know, to move on and go elsewhere in the UN system or in their own country. But it's given people that, you know, that access. They can get the first rung on the career ladder. And I think that's, you know, that's the kind of thing, given where I come from, I think, you know, where I could never have envisaged doing an unpaid internship.
Yeah.
You know, that's for me something that links my personal passion with being able to make an impact for the organization.
Thank you for sharing that. Maybe a bit outward looking. You, in the strategy, you speak about being an employer of choice. So can you elaborate what that means for people that want to apply at the UNDP? And maybe it has an impact on what you're looking for.
I think one of the things you can say about UNDP is it's, you know, it's not a business to consumer organization. Like, we don't have a necessarily, or you call it a consumer brand or a public facing brand necessarily, because most of our work is directed towards supporting governments around the world. And so I think many people who are interested in working in the UN or in development don't all know about the opportunities that there are in UNDP.
Mm-hmm.
So a huge piece of work is to get out there and make sure that, you know, young people coming out of university and others are aware of what we do and the fantastic opportunities there are. We just weren't telling people. And then really to set out, knowing that people have so many choices about where they go and work, even in the development sphere,
mm-hmm.
why should they come and work for us? And so we put together a very clear, what we will call in the HR jargon, the employee value proposition. So a very clear statement of why, you know, people want to come here in terms of, you know, being a part of next generation thinking, being part of a, you know, fantastic community of practice and developing yourself personally and professionally. And to then articulate that so that we're able, you know, people can see, you know, what the jobs are really about, can see what, you know, through interacting with people, you know, what is it, the kind of thing that you do, and how can people access those opportunities. So we've, you know, we put that employee value proposition together, and then a very clear recruitment marketing strategy. And we can see that that's, you know, really borne huge dividends for the organization. So since 2021, I think we've now had a 9,000% increase in our UNDP LinkedIn careers website. In fact, just this week, it went over the 500,000 mark.
Wow. Congratulations.
And we started with a few thousand. Right. So, you know, we have 500,000. We have, I think, double the average click-through rate on LinkedIn. And that's because we have some great content going on there. You know, it's not just leave some static thing. There's constantly content. People can interact. People can see what we're doing. And that's actually driven a 35% increase year on year in the number of applications to UNDP.
Wow.
Well, that is a big achievement. I mean, yeah. That's usually the biggest.
No,
go ahead.
And that's down to some fantastic work, I have to say. The credit not to me, but to our colleagues in our talent acquisition team based in Copenhagen, who have really done some amazing work there.
Well, I'm going to check it out. That's really good.
you can be the 500,000 and first,
exactly. Yes. Person. Maybe I should just go to Copenhagen. But okay, also nice. And a bit of a different question. We all speak a lot about diversity and inclusion. And to my mind, and here I don't want to be too pessimistic, this is often easier said than done. I mean, I personally believe that people ultimately want to do the right thing, right? But how do you see this? And what do you consider the major challenges? I mean, the UNDP is a very large organization. So,
indeed. Well, I think, you know, DEI is a theme that's really risen up the consciousness of organizations globally over the last 2 or 3 years for all the reasons I don't need to go into. But for UNDP, of course, as a global United Nations organization, I think we're already an incredibly diverse organization. I mean, we operate in over 170 countries. And I think diversity means different things, depending on which part of the world, you know, you happen to be working in. But, you know, for me, it's absolutely crucial. I mean, yes, we are a diverse organization, but how can we be more diverse? And that doesn't mean necessarily looking at people's ethnic background necessarily, or their religion, or whether they're from an indigenous group, whether people have a disability. There are all these different parameters that we need to look at. And also, what kind of people, you know, are you bringing into your organizations? You know, you also want diversity of thought. You want diversity of social background and diversity of experience. And so we have, you know, the UNDP has this year adopted its first ever DEI strategy. So we spent, you know, some time actually really preparing this, you know, thoroughly. It's been launched, and there are lots of now initiatives that are taking flight within the organization and across the world to actually give life to that. One of them is a new kind of speak up initiative that we're rolling out now to really ensure that people feel free to express themselves and talk about some of these things and their experiences. We also have, as part of our new employee listening architecture, every year there's going to be a diversity survey dedicated to that we're about to, in fact, it's the second of our new survey series that we're about to launch. And one of the things I think for me has the potential to be a huge game changer, and along with the intern thing, is the thing I'm most, you know, proud of, whatever you want to call it, is our new graduate program that now is in its second year.
Is it?
About to go into the third. And the idea is that if you come from, you know, it's very hard for young people, as I mentioned, to find their way into the UN. How, you know, you start somewhere. It seems like an enormous organization. How do you get in there? Very difficult. And one of the primary ways for, and it's a fantastic opportunity for those that can have it, is the Junior Professional Officer program that UNDP actually operates on behalf of the UN system.
Yeah.
And with a couple of exceptions, countries who participate obviously are sending their own nationals to, and many of those people, very, very smart, talented, dedicated people, stay in the UN. If you're not from one of those countries or you don't have the opportunity, it's very difficult. So we've created this new graduate program, and it's specifically targeted at people who wouldn't have been eligible. So we've targeted it at the least represented countries from program countries in our organization. But more importantly, we want to get different kinds of people from those countries. So people who have experienced the kind of problems that we're trying to work with countries to solve. So we've set up some very specific criteria that we are looking for. And we've really changed this selection procedure very radically. It's not the usual kind of competency-based selection procedure either, because a lot of people, if they're more from the bottom of the pile, they haven't had the opportunities to talk about in a competency-based interview. You know, tell me about when you did this. Well, if you've never had the opportunity, then you haven't got much to say, and they are at a disadvantage. So we went for a strengths-based selection process where we're focusing on more what people are passionate about rather than what they've already done, again, to level the playing field. So when we put that out, we were inundated. We had almost 38,000 applications from around the world. So that really shows that, you know, that many, many people want to do that. We were only able to take the top 18, so you can imagine how good they are.
Yeah, I was.
But giving people a two-year experience in UNDP on a staff contract that very much mirrors, you know, the support, the training and things that the JPOs get. So that's really important. And then we're also doing, and I should say, we actually won an award for that from the Chartered Institute of Personnel Development last year. We won one of their people management awards for that initiative and two other awards for that graduate program. So I think you can see that, you know, we're really doing something very different, very new. And I think it's the right thing to be doing for the UN and for UNDP. The other thing, for example, a great example is our partnership with our Regional Bureau for Africa. We help support a Young African Women's Fellowship Program in partnership with the African Union. And then we're bringing in a few dozen really bright young women every year to spend a year or two in our organization. And many of them stay after, some go back to the AU, they go back to other organizations, back to their home countries, but with an enormously enhanced skill set. So when it comes to sustainably in the long term changing the DNA of the organization, that I think is an incredibly powerful way of going about it.
Yeah. It's very interesting what you're mentioning about your selection process. Leading into the next question, talent acquisition, as it's usually done, has its hurdles, so to speak. On the one hand, the grading system within the UN, because it is quite a rigid framework. For a certain grade level role, you need to have so many years of experience, you need to have that kind of education. But very often, I've run into people that didn't have that education, but might have been, or they were expert in their field. So you got the situation like, this person doesn't have a university degree. Yeah, but they've been 15 plus years the expert on this particular topic. Now what? So, I mean, I don't think it's fit for purpose anymore in this day and age, but can I ask what your view is on this?
Well, if you step outside the kind of public sector bubble, of course, there's a difference between the way much or all of the public sector, you know, structures itself and the kind of grading system. And the private sector. So you can see, you know, and there's a lot of commonality wherever you go in the world, you know, in public sector, that seems to be the way it's always operated. And you can see that there's some disconnect between that and, and a more modern way that the private sector does. But of course, we're also working, you know, in a public system with clear rules of accountability for things. And so I think we do need to have much more kind of structure and order than necessarily you might have to have in the private sector. It's just we're spending the public's money, for example, and we have to have proper, you know, systems of accountability. And ultimately, you know, you need some kind of a of a hierarchy and of responsibilities, and that rests on the system that we have today. No system is perfect. I don't think we can necessarily change that overnight, or is, you know, that's not easy to do. But in my view, I mean, I've talked about some of the things we're doing for people with people 2030. Actually, it's not necessarily a hindrance to you doing what you want to do. I mean, we've been able to do all of the things I've been talking about and more. So, you know, I think there are flexibilities you can introduce. One of the things, for example, is that we're moving away from as many posts as possible from routinely requiring people to have a master's to come to the organization. Because I think very often people just simply can't afford to stay at university and do a master's, or they might want to do one later in life. I don't have a master's, for example. You know, when I finished university, I really needed to go and get a job. I couldn't afford another few years of university, and so I got a job. Has the master's prevented me from, you know, having the career I've had? No. And so that's an obvious way, I think, where we can exclude fewer people. Enable people to come with a bachelor's and maybe a couple of years more experience, rather than say, if you haven't got a master's, you can't come in here. So I think there's scope for us to be more flexible.
Yep.
And that's what we're certainly trying to do.
Thanks for sharing your view on that. Do you have a personal trait that has been critical for your success?
Dear, I'm not sure I'm the best person to ask. I mean...
Okay, why is that? Why would you say that?
You might... I don't know. Well, I think it'd be more interesting to see what the people who work with me say, or maybe ask my wife that question. But I suppose I'll answer it this way. When I was the director of the European Personnel Selection Office, I spent quite a lot of my time going around the EU, talking to young people about careers in the European Union. And the question I would often get is, in your competency framework, which is the most important one in your opinion? And I always gave the same answer: it's resilience. And I suppose that's how I'd answer your question, because I don't know, for good or bad, I've spent most of my professional life changing things and trying to make things better. That's what drives me. And I think that if you're going to make a difference anywhere, you need resilience, because there are always obstacles wherever you are, whatever you do. And I see too many people who give up at the first or the second. And I don't give up. I don't give up very easily, or I don't give up at all. And I think if I hadn't had, by some luck, that quality of resilience, you know, I don't think I'd have had the drive to do all of the things I've done, to, you know, leave the little seaside town where I grew up in and go to university a long way away and study and go and live abroad and join the EU and all these different things. And you know, you have a certain drive, but a certain resilience that even if it doesn't work the first time or you get pushback, I don't give up. And I think that's really, really important. It doesn't mean you don't listen to people, you don't accept feedback, you don't course correct if things, you know, don't work out or you fail at something, but don't give up, you know, change it and try again. And, you know, if you just keep on going and you're, you know, convinced that what you're doing is the right thing, then I think, you know, that's a really important quality. And I think that's something that has enabled me to not just talk about changing things, but actually change them.
Resilience was the key word.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
If you could share a wish right now for what you would like to bring to the world, I know it sounds fluffy, but I really mean it.
Ah, where do you start? I mean,
what would it be?
The world needs a lot of things, but I think one thing that's really struck me working in the UN for the last 5 years, you know, is the importance of listening to the other person's perspective before doing something or rushing to judgment. And I think, you know, people, there's a tendency to want to reduce things to black and white, but even worse, that I think people want to see things from their own perspective. And it seems very difficult for somebody to put themselves in another person's shoes on the other side of a debate or whatever it happens to be and say, well, why does that person think that way? What, you know, they have a legitimate perspective. And I think this ability, if people have more of an ability to stop and try and see things from the other person's perspective, then we have an awful lot less trouble in the world.
Thank you, David. And thank you for this podcast, being a guest here. Really appreciate it. And
no, pleasure.
Thank you. And let me conclude with wishing you good luck with everything that the UNDP is doing. I find it very fascinating to also hear about it. It sounds very promising.
Thanks a lot. Well, real pleasure. And if people are listening, please go and look on our LinkedIn, UNDP Careers page on LinkedIn, or on our UNDP site for People for 2030 if you want to find out more.
Absolutely. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in again, and we will be back with a new podcast soon. Bye-bye.